This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we assess the meaning and trajectory of last week's presidential election.
We first speak with Richard Becker, the leader of the Party of Socialism and Liberation. We also speak with Margaret Kimberly, the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report.
She clearly lays out the disastrous Democratic Party policies that led to their defeat and to Trump's popularity.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The election of Donald Trump as our next president exposed a number of truths, really, about where we, the people, are at, because there could be no doubt, certainly in the minds of those who elected him, what Donald Trump intends and has promised to do once he's back in the White House. There was really nothing vague about his program, his platform, although he was sometimes accused of being so by the Democrats. He made it clear he believes that only he and other strong men, and that strong men, not strong women, by the way, should rule America. Women, in fact, are really too weak or apparently even unable to know what's in their best interest, but never mind, he will protect them. He believes and says openly as well that he was chosen by the God that he proclaims to believe in to be our leader now. He openly says that. He says he's going to rule as a dictator, at least on the first day, if need be, and from time to time, why do we need the Constitution? He intends to rid this country of millions of our immigrant sisters and brothers so that their so-called evil blood and criminal ways will no longer infect true Americans. And he talks about reinstituting stop and frisk laws, which of course always target people of color, to end crime. And despite all of this and more, a majority of us have voted to give him the chance to do exactly what he has said, what he has promised to do. So yes, we will now have as a president an admitted wishful authoritarian, a man who those who know him best say is a fascist. We can only wonder, with fear in our hearts or questions in our minds, what a second Trump administration will mean for the poor, for the working class, for women, for immigrants, for people of color, and for freedom of the press and freedom of speech. And we must also engage in such wondering, in no small part, because of how the millions of voters from those very groups of Americans were so worried about him and that he has targeted for corrective action, voted for him, and what it's going to mean for them nevertheless. So today we've invited back to our show a leading member of the truly progressive movement here in America to discuss what this second Trump presidency will likely mean for we the people and, well, how those who are opposed to it can best mobilize to oppose its planned legislation and executive orders, plan a fight-back effort, if you will, against the unprecedented authoritarianism that many fear now awaits us come next January. Our guest is Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the West Coast Regional Coordinator of the ANSWER Coalition. That's the Act Now to Stop War and End Racism Coalition. He is the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, and there's an update, by the way, to that book, and the author as well of The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. I should add that Richard Becker is also one of this nation's most dedicated and considered one of the most effective political organizers on behalf of various peace and social and economic justice causes. So, Richard Becker, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks very much for the invitation.
If you read the New York Times this morning, for example, or yesterday, but even more so today, there's an expression of great shock and great panic on the part of the Democrats, great shock on the part of many people. My God, we've gone through some screen into in reality, into a fully fascist governance or something, you know, a certain alarmist view about what a decidedly, obviously more right-wing U.S. government will do and will mean. That's all understandable. But the degree to which people react to it as though it's an animal they've never seen before in any form strikes me as odd. And I,
I'm aware of how your party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, as well as other socialist parties and groupings, often talk about how America has really never been a fully democratic nation anyway, how over its existence it has rather steadily become less and less democratic, less so. Indeed, the world organization that rates, you know, the world's democracies has steadily over the several hundred years, or as long as they've been in existence, placed us further down the list of democracies. We're no longer considered a true democracy anyway. And your party points out how the ever more powerful role over all this time played by capitalism in America is really the cause of and is manifesting now in a very clear way the corporate capitalist oligarchy that runs the country, so that to call ourselves a democratic nation anyway makes less sense, so that it's not so much that we should panic, but we should sort of understand how we got to where we've gotten to. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think it's very important to have an assessment of what has just happened and why it has happened, and why Trump will return to the White House with his whole gang of horrific characters who promote racism and misogyny and homophobia and transphobia, and they're anti-worker and pro-war and all of that. Why are they back in? That's really the question. And what do they intend to do? And what do we intend to do? There were periods in U.S. history for a long time, from the very beginning, of course, when black people had no rights until the Civil War of 1860. I think it's interesting that we hear the same thing every 2 or 4 years, and that is, this is the most important election that's ever happened. This is what, in 2020, it was what happened in 2016. But really, the election of 1860 was considerably more important and led the way to the Civil War, which was the only way to bring an end to slavery, in fact. But then there was after a period of progression, there was a period of retreat in the form of the defeat of Reconstruction in the 1870s and the decades that followed. And really, for the next 90 years, we saw that. You know, there were two periods of time in the 1930s when the people rose up, the time of the Great Depression. Labor achieved legality. The Social Security programs came into existence. They didn't exist before. If you got sick or you were disabled, your family could starve if you couldn't work. And that was a period of great uprising of the masses of people and the winning of rights. And the other period was in the 1960s and into the 1970s, when an end to apartheid American style, at least the legal form of it, was brought about by another uprising of the masses. And the black struggle, the civil rights movement, also led to the women's movement and to gay movement and the environmental movement, immigrant rights movement, Puerto Rican movement, American Indian movement, all of these, they were all products. And I'm saying all this because what we think the Trump administration intends is to take away as many of those rights as possible. And what will they be able to do it? That will depend on the struggle of people and how organized the progressive people are, people who are pro-socialist, as more and more people are these days, but people who want to fight against what the Trump administration has in mind. And exactly what the Trump administration has in mind is to repeal as many of the rights of the people as they possibly can do. So the question, you know, of course, immediately comes up, if we say that, and I am, why then did they win? Why did they win? Well, I think it's because the Democrats have been an utter failure. They have been a failure. If you look at what, since 2020, the election of 2020, when Biden won, and the years that followed that, the first, when he came in 2021, the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate. And yet, they didn't do what needed to be done. In fact, they did the opposite. They repealed the moratorium on evictions that had come about through the pandemic. And when the Democrats are in control, they got rid of the child assistance program that was providing $300 a month per child to families, and really made the difference between whether or not people could survive, they could stay in their homes, they could. And then on top of that, we had this huge inflation. And the inflation, you know, all of a sudden, poor people were, their wages were stagnant or going backwards, actually going backwards because of real wages, because of inflation. Suddenly you went in the supermarket and if you looked at everything seemed to double or tripled in price. So there was this inflation, and the Democrats are so committed to one thing above all else, and that's war. The war in Ukraine, which is intended to weaken Russia at the cost of any number of Ukrainian lives as well as Russian lives, and billions, tens of billions of dollars were going to that, and tens of billions of dollars going to the genocide in Gaza. What the Democrats have done paved the way. You know, when people look at this, they look at the political situation, the average person who's thinking about it and who's being affected by the economy and who's looking at what's happening. If that's not working, if the Democrats are not working for them, then they feel there's only one other possibility. And you have this demagogue, this horrific character, Trump, but who's promising, I'll fix it. I'll make it all better. Of course, he's not going to. He's going to make it all better for the super rich. But I think that that's how we have to see this, is that the Democrats, what the Democrats have had on offer to the people, has resulted in them being defeated in this election.
And aren't you also saying, though, that that the Democrats and the Republicans, while they may be on different continuums on the spectrum of believing that capitalism and capitalist governance is the only way for America, the fact is that, therefore, neither party is offering a different way. And when capitalism falls into its predictable periodic lulls in terms of producing anything at all, the inflation gets high, the unemployment gets high, and so forth. Corrective measures may be taken, but not in time enough to stop the fears, the immigration, the other, all of that, that capitalism is not equipped to deal with that, and that the Democrats aren't really any better equipped to deal with it in the long run than are the Republicans. And therefore, a cough medicine salesman like Trump comes along, plays on their fears, and doesn't promise them a new form of government, but simply talks boldly about he can fix it. I mean, that's at the root of capitalism itself, isn't it, in the system that we're under? I mean, is that really, therefore, unpredictable that this would happen?
Well, it's really not. I don't think it's unpredictable at all. You know, the Republicans, we know who the Republicans are. I mean, I think probably most of the listeners have a pretty good take on that. But the Democrats are a party that's base is made up of working class people, middle class people overwhelmingly, but its leadership is completely devoted to the capitalist system. They are as devoted, and they've proven it over and over again to such an extent that if you look at the last two elections before this one, the 2016 election and the 2020 election, had the primary process gone on for the Democrats in any kind of a legitimate way, Bernie Sanders would have been the candidate. And I say this because while Sanders is not a revolutionary, he's a democratic socialist, as he defines himself. It was considered to be so dangerous that someone like Bernie Sanders could occupy the White House, and that would give such encouragement to people to fight for what they really need. The most illegitimate, deceitful means were used in both 2016 and 2020, especially when all the other, in 2020, we should remember that in the just the day before, a few days before the Super Tuesday, which was a decisive day of primary elections, Sanders was leading. Biden was in fourth or fifth place and considering dropping out when the Democratic establishment intervened and got everyone else to drop out and endorse Biden. And, you know, so you have someone like Biden who has long proven himself to be a servant of the rich, allied with some of the worst elements early in his career, the worst racist elements, completely devoted to war. Yet the Democratic leadership preferred to have the Republicans win to have Trump win than to have someone like Sanders in the White House. And it shows how devoted, I think, just how really devoted they are to the defense of the capitalist system. And therefore, they are not able, from the leadership position of the Democratic Party, they're not able to present to people what would really be very popular, and like housing, healthcare, education, jobs, and more as guarantees to the population. That could be done. That could be done, but that would run counter to the interest of the capitalist class.
I find it interesting, Richard, that in this morning's New York Times, for example, there are a number of articles that, in a sense, strike one as odd, or strike me at least as odd. They speak of a certain bewilderment or confusion or lack of understanding or something. I mean, you see articles like titled, "For Black Women, America Has Revealed to Us Her True Self." Well, my goodness, I mean, just now? Come on. I mean, that's not my experience of my black friends, that they have suddenly discovered what this country has been about. Or "Resist or Retreat, Democrats Are Torn About Whether to Keep Fighting." I mean, all these kind of apocalyptical, bizarre statements, again, to me, expressing a lack of understanding what I think you're talking about. In other words, making this seem as though the election of Trump is somehow a sport. It's somehow something that's not expected to have ever happened in America, totally out of keeping with anything our country has ever been, where, as I think you're describing, that's not been the case. Have there not, for example, been many periods in the history of this country where there have been strong degrees of repression? The Immigrant Alien Acts, for example, during the McCarthy period, when you had extreme poverty equal or surpassing even what we have today, and tent cities were existing all over the country. This isn't the first time the poor have had to live in tents in our country, for God's sakes. It may be extreme in terms of the last 20, 30, 40 years, but it's not a period of time that is all that familiar historically to the American people, I think, for the reasons you're describing, Richard. So talk to us a bit about that, and then I want to talk to what we do about the two-party system, or what can be done or you think should be done about that.
Well, it's certainly true what you're saying, that this is not new. And we'll have people saying this is the worst time ever because Trump has been elected. But no, the worst time ever was slavery. The worst time ever was the Ku Klux Klan, which ruled a lot of the country in the 1920s. I just saw something. I'm from Rochester, New York, originally. I just saw a photo of a march by the Ku Klux Klan in East Rochester, which is a suburb, in 1927, and there were 8,000 people in that. The Ku Klux Klan ruled a lot of the country. This is what also those who are talking about critical race theory and all that, that they want to ban it. They want to ban an understanding of the real history of the United States. It's really important. I mean, once you really see that history and how ethnicity after ethnicity has been subjected to all kinds of exploitation and brutality, and that has been integral to the history of the United States. So what we're seeing today is appalling, the outcome of the election in many ways. And I think for oppressed groups, and particularly for women, it's shocking that someone like this could be elected again. It's not a return to, at least not yet, and that's what the struggle has to be about. The struggle has to be a struggle over defending the rights that have been won and winning new rights. That's what's essential. If we can't do that, then the Trump and the capitalist class who he represents, they will win. So that's really the question about what's coming.
As you were reciting those examples of Ku Klux Klan, I'm thinking of people have made so much of the big rally at Madison Square Garden that Trump had an eve pretty much of the election. Well, what about the big Nazi gathering there, you know, at the time of the Second World War, before the Second World War? So this isn't something that we've not seen before. We don't teach much history in our schools anymore. There's not a great sense of history among, I think, the average one of us in this country, and so we tend to lose sight of what you're pointing out. The other part of this that I wanted to get to, Richard, whenever it's presidential election time, or any election time, really, liberals and many progressives argue that while it's true neither capitalist candidate or party can or will do what really needs doing to meet the full needs of the American people, that we've got to hold our noses and vote for the lesser of the two evils of them, since that is the only meaningful choice we could have, to vote for any third-party candidate, even a socialist party candidate, who we might think has a better idea. Indeed, you is to throw away our vote. Indeed, polls of young people in this country today, 17 to 18 to 29-year-olds, show they would prefer a socialist economic system, really, to the capitalist one. And even among registered Democrats, actually, there's been a poll that shows most actually registered or, you know, kind of card-carrying Democrats think the economic system we have is inferior to what a socialist economic system would be. But so talk to us a bit about that, because the question that arises is that, okay, but how do we get past that? We don't have a parliamentary system. How do we get over the lesser of two? How do we have meaningful third parties that can actually challenge for power? How can the people begin to break away from this system? Talk to us about that, Richard.
Yeah, you know, just to elaborate a little bit more, when I said 1927 in East Rochester, the Klan 8,000 march, the Klan at that time controlled many of the states in the country. They controlled Oregon, the legislature. And not just the South, they controlled the Indiana government. They controlled a large part of the country, and it's not all that long ago. So you mentioned the Madison Square Garden rally and that took place in I think 1938 or 39, the pro-Nazi rally. That was a characteristic of a large part of the population. Was drawn toward that at the time because a large part of the U.S. ruling class was pro-Nazi, and that's a part of the reality. You know, when we ask the question of how do we go from here to get past the lesser evils, I think it's worth looking at the electoral system and the way it's been set up. In many, many states, the Democrats and Republicans don't have to do anything to get on the ballot. But in every state, a third party has to go through a procedure that is unique to that state or the District of Columbia. So there's 50 different procedures in order to qualify for a federal office. The system has been built in a way, constructed in a way, and as you mentioned, it's not a parliamentary system. So unless you win everything, unless you win outright, you have no representation in the government. And that goes for the state governments for the most part, as well as the federal government. So what's really needed is to build a new party. And what we keep hearing in election after election after election is, you're throwing away your vote if you vote for a third party. If third parties run, they're just hurting you know, the Democrats and the progressive third parties, because there's right-wing ones too. But we have to build something different. We need to construct, we need to build a new movement. That's what's absolutely essential. And sometimes, you know, and I think this is very important, is that new movements often come out of the most reactionary circumstances. If you had said to people, on November 30th, 1955, if you said, you know, and this was in the height of McCarthyism and segregation was still there and all of that, if you would have said, you know, I think tomorrow something's going to happen in Montgomery, Alabama, and it eventually will change the country and change the world, you would have gotten very few takers. I think, you said, what? Are you crazy? But the reality is that next day was December 1st, and it was the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott, Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat in what was a planned action. And that led to a year-long, the planners didn't think it would, but it was such a it received such powerful response from the black population in Montgomery, continued for a year. It really was what launched the civil rights movement, which became a mass movement that really fundamentally changed the U.S. in many ways, not fundamentally enough, but in very, very important ways. My point is, we don't know when things are coming. No one really knew that was going to happen. And many of the developments are a surprise. Almost everything is a surprise to people. You don't know where you are in the middle of the historical process. No one really knows that because you're in the middle of it. So we don't control that. We don't have any control of it. What we do have control over is building popular organization and mobilization. And we are going to need to do that.
I was thinking as you were talking about how when Trump was elected the first time, one of the largest demonstrations, certainly by women and others, took place immediately around his time of his inauguration. That immigration law was proposed in the Congress a couple of decades ago now. It brought literally over a million people, immigrants, into the streets of Los Angeles, underscoring your point that in the face of it, it's often that kind of repression that lays bare the lie of what American governance really is, and so you have a stronger response. People give up their kind of stupor of thinking, well, things, I guess, are okay. They understand the need, the desperate need, and it's during those periods of time, it's been, in fact, during that period of time, that growth and the belief that the capitalist system is not the system that's going to save us has grown stronger and stronger in America, even as there is still a dominance because of the fear and the racism and all the rest that you point out that elects a Trump. So what I hear you saying is that Trump's election may, in a funny way, not surprising way perhaps, prompt a renewal of the kind of movement to protect rights, to advance rights, and to look at the political structure of America that otherwise might not come about.
I think that's very true. You know, I remember I was there on 2006. Was it 2006 or 2000? Yeah. It was the Sensenbrenner bill. And the Sensenbrenner was the heir to the Kleenex fortune. And he proposed that a bill that would make it a felony to be in the country illegally. And, you know, it got on the Spanish radio stations. And, you know, everywhere people said, you know, we grow your food, we take care of your children, we build your buildings, we put the roofs on your buildings, and now you're going to call us felons? And it got out on the Spanish radio stations. And I think on May 1st of that year, 15 million people, immigrants and supporters, either struck or demonstrated or did both. Unfortunately, what happened after that was that the leadership got taken over under the slogan, hoy marchamos, mañana votamos, meaning today we march and tomorrow we vote. And the movement kind of crumbled in many ways. It didn't completely crumble, of course, but it contracted very sharply. And the hope was all put on the Democrats putting through a law. Now we've had this huge outpouring. Now we'll count on the Democrats putting forward a law. And nothing has happened since then. I think that's a lesson, that we have to have an independent movement. If the movement is tied to the Democrats, time after time after time, the movement ends up losing. And the Democrats try to divert it into the electoral arena, which isn't unimportant. But it can't be the main arena, because if it is the main arena, I think what has been shown in the immigrant rights struggle and so many other struggles is that it will lose. Our side will lose.
As we draw closer to the end of this interview, the fear that has been conveyed as to what a Trump presidency will mean. I mean, he's a fascist, after all. Are we now a fascist country and so forth? He's going to use the military and as well as everybody else to crack down on dissent and on the enemies within us and within our country and all the rest. That can have a chilling effect. I remember when the American Patriot Act was passed, and people would often ask,
the ACLU, or they'd ask other groups, you know, well, what should we do? We're afraid. What you should do is protest the Patriot Act. What you should do is get out there in the streets and let the government understand that you will not be silenced. The way to fight that kind of fear is to fight it, is to not be afraid, is to be angry, to be thoughtful, and to organize. So, Richard, are you hopeful? Are you fearful, or are you hopeful, or both, that a Trump presidency, in fact, might bring about an even strengthening of the kinds of movements that have periodically, the Black Lives Matter movement, the movement you talked about immigrants, that might congeal and come together even more powerful in the face of Trump, and that might end up historically representing a period of growth for what peace and justice advocates want for America, even under Trump?
Well, that's what's going to be needed, because Trump, we have to be realistic. Trump has a program, and the people around him who built the program, to get rid of everything that stands in the way of maximum profitization, if that's a word. Well, that's what his intent is. So whether it's the environment, or it's workers' rights, or it's women's rights, or LGBT rights, and whatever is in the way, they're going to try to destroy it. And they're going to come after, we believe, you know, they're coming after the left, and there's going to be repression or attempts at it. But the only way to stop that is going to be to fight. To fight back, to organize, to find the ways to build united fronts against what the Trump program is. That's what's going to be essential. If people want to get more information about what we're doing, what the PSL is doing, a good place to start is liberationnews.org, liberationnews.org, and you can read our current statement on the Trump administration.
Richard Becker, we thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Democratic Party presidential candidate Kamala Harris lost the election contest to Donald Trump by a large margin, both in Electoral College and by the popular vote. Harris was placed at the top of the ticket by the elites in the Democratic Party and their very rich donors. She was chosen even though she got not a single primary vote. Her program was devoid of any vigorous social democratic policies like those proposed by Bernie Sanders that could have won people over. She remained tied to the Biden administration, particularly with respect to the genocide America is supporting in Palestine. Harris was a disaster for the Democratic Party. The majority of American voters wanted change. Above all, they wanted change. Trump represented that. Trump scapegoated immigrants. It was quite obviously that he was a misogynist, a racist, and a crude and cruel vulgarian. This was overlooked, accepted, or even embraced by the millions of people who supported him. Today we speak with Margaret Kimberly, the executive director of the Black Agenda Report and the author of the book Prejudicial. Margaret Kimberly, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Margaret, in the last election cycle, people on the left took various positions. Some said, we'll not cross class lines. The Democratic Party is a capitalist party, and therefore we will not vote for it. They agreed with Eugene V. Debs, who said, I'd rather vote for something I want and not get it than vote for something I don't want and get it. Others articulated the position that Trump was qualitatively worse. He was a fascist, and that we had to keep him out of office no matter what, so that he wouldn't get his hands on the power of the state. Still others took a third position. In swing states, people should vote against Trump, but in states that were solidly Democratic, like New York, they could vote for something that they want, like the program of Jill Stein or Cornel West, or the Party of Socialism and Liberation in California. What did you advocate?
I advocate that people do what they want. I think everyone should vote for whomever they want to vote for, regardless of where they live. If you live in a swing state and you want to vote for the Green Party or Cornel West or Party of Socialism and Liberation, go ahead and do that. People should vote for whomever they want. It is up to the political parties, especially the Democrats, who raised $1 billion for the Harris campaign. It's up to them to get their votes out. And no one should deprive themselves of the choices they want to make electorally. So I advocate people voting for whomever they want, wherever they are.
Yes, Margaret, the great Glenn Ford has been, well, gone now for several years. He was your mentor. Ford profoundly observed that the Democrats was not the lesser of two evils, as many people on the left believe and act on. But in reality, the Democrats were, and I quote, more effective of two evils, close quote. How do you appreciate this with respect to organizing and fighting Trump and Trumpism in the period ahead?
Well, you know, Glenn was, may he rest in peace, he was absolutely right. This idea that there's some qualitative difference between Democrats and Republicans is obviously false. Let's just look at history of, let's say, just the last 30 years. Who pushed welfare, so-called reform, which impoverished millions of people? Well, that was Bill Clinton, a Democrat. Bill Clinton also consolidated the media. So we went from having hundreds of media companies to having just a handful, which of course impacts political discourse because there are fewer and fewer outlets for people such as ourselves to access or to listen to. Who bailed out the banks? The Wall Street, the crash in, happened in the fall of 2008, and Obama was about to become president a few months later. He gave trillions of dollars to the financial services industry. Bill Clinton's the one who deregulated the financial services industry. Who is carrying out a genocide in Gaza right now? It's Joe Biden and the Democrats. Well, actually, it's a bipartisan policy. So Democrats, they have this impression and this reputation of from FDR and from LBJ, from Lyndon Johnson. What did Biden's team say? He was the most progressive president since FDR. They had to go back 80 years to find someone they wanted to compare him to, because there were, you know, the COVID era programs lasted very briefly, but now they're gone. They're gone completely. So you have a party with the veneer of being more enlightened, the party whose members want peace. So the party apparatus itself gets to pretend it's like its voters, who, if it were up to Democratic Party voters, there wouldn't be any genocide in going on in Gaza right now. There would not have been any deregulation of financial services. There wouldn't have been any bailout of the banks, or no bailout of the banks without a comparable bailout of working people. So that's the kind of thing that that Glenn was talking about, that Obama was able to destroy Libya and kill Muammar Gaddafi. Reagan tried it, but the guy who got it done was Obama, who still many people who, because they're not informed or because they like to live in a fantasy land, like to pretend he was such some kind of a good guy.
Yeah, I'll say. Margaret Kimberly, I'm going to ask you a two-part question, really. Who are the figures in the ruling class who are behind Trump, and who are the figures behind Harris?
Well, there are more ruling class people behind Harris. She raised more than twice as much as Trump, as I said, $1 billion, and Trump a mere $400 million. There could be some dark money in there, so that number may go up, but those were the last figures that were reported. Trump's his biggest ruling class supporter, most visible, most prominent, is Elon Musk, the richest person in the world. Tesla Automotive, SpaceX, the owner of the X platform, formerly Twitter, and other interests. He's the most prominent of all of the mega wealthy Trump donors. But there were others as well, people such as Miriam Adelson, Linda McMahon, Peter Thiel, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, T-H-I-L, These are some of the people who are regular donors to Republicans and to Trump himself. Harris has the Silicon Valley people. They are backers of the Democrats. The crypto industry, they're backers of Harris. You know, it's funny, the donors, they're the ones who decided to get rid of Biden. So people like the heiress to Walt Disney, whose name is now blanking on her name, but there are folks like that who were quite adamant that Biden had to get out. But I think the biggest point is that they're both ruling class parties. They may have slightly different interests, but they are of one mind about neoliberalism, about getting richer, which by definition means that the people are not allowed to prosper, that there is no raising of the minimum wage, that the COVID-era protection programs all disappear. I think that's the most important thing. They're both capitalist parties with varying members of the ruling class giving them direction.
You know, Margaret, I suspect one thing that almost all of us can agree on is that Donald Trump is not your everyday presidential candidate. And as time has gone on and he's gotten older, he's become an even more unusual or bizarre candidate. His long, rambling speeches, the negativity that he constantly expresses, in this campaign, the growing use of profanity and misogynistic statements, the clear evidence from his remarks and his speeches now that his mind is not sharp, that he's suffering either some dementia or something. So despite all of that, though, despite all of that, it's clear that he was the most popular candidate, despite those personality qualities and behaviors. In fact, he won the popular vote this time, not only the Electoral College vote. What is it that made him so popular that he won this election?
Well, Trump is he's an interesting person. First of all, he's a media figure. He's a man who always promoted himself. He promoted himself as being this successful businessman, which he was not, by the way. Filed bankruptcy, I believe, 5 times, or was it 6 times? Inherited his wealth from his father, but promoted himself very adroitly. And I think the biggest reason he became president was that there was a reality show built around him, The Apprentice, which was millions of people watched. It was a very highly rated show. He made a lot of money. So he had a brand that he lived up to. And so people admired him for his wealth, although, as I said before, he was at towards the end of his real estate career, he was just selling his name, not really building anything himself. But so that's the first thing. He's a person who developed this persona, but he also expresses what millions of people believed. Looking back when he said, "I'll build a wall and make Mexico pay for it," I believe he earned millions of votes just with that statement. Being a media person, a savvy media person, he knows something like "Make America Great Again" resonates with many white people, that there was a time when the country was great for them. Before there were any laws to keep them from getting their way, before any Civil Rights Act or Voting Rights Act, before discrimination was perfectly legal, when gender discrimination was perfectly legal. So this image of a strong, rich white man is something that's very powerful. And they ignored that at their peril. Hillary is very funny to me. In 2016, Hillary Clinton promoted him to some of her media friends because she thought he would be easiest to beat, although he's the one who actually defeated her with his Electoral College victory. And there are people who admire his brashness, who admire that he says anything he wants. They say he speaks his mind. He speaks their minds. He says things they want to say. And when he was hit with these court cases after he left office, he said, "To hell with that, I'm going to run again." And I think by virtue of doing those things, it made him even more popular with his base. And we see that on election day, he got nearly as many votes as he got in 2020, while Kamala Harris not only came up short against him, but had many fewer votes, latest estimates about 15 million fewer votes than Biden got in 2020.
We're speaking with Margaret Kimmerly here on Law and Disorder. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty. I'm Michael Smith. Margaret, now that Trump is president, the forces that prepared Project 2025, we expect will try to bring it about. What is Project 2025? Who designed it?
Project 2025 is the latest iteration of the right-wing wish list for a new administration. So it comes from a right-wing think tank. It has everything they want. They'll get rid of the Department of Education. They'll change immigration law. They'll ban, medical care for trans people. They'll undo civil rights legislation. It's all in one fell swoop. And it, when it was written by people who came from his first administration, now when it became a Democratic Party talking point, they disavowed it. And Trump said, I never heard anything about it. It's not something I worried about, frankly, because these are the things that conservatives always say they're going to do. They just put it all in one document. But sometimes, for example, Obamacare was what was recommended by the Heritage Foundation. Clinton's, I mentioned, is welfare reform. This was also something that the right wing had dreamed about for decades. So sometimes it's Democrats who give us, as we were just discussing with their effective evil. So they will do, but basically Trump won both houses of Congress. He'll do whatever he wants to do. Whatever it is they think they can get past, that's what they will do.
You know, Margaret, several years ago, you wrote the book titled Prejudential. If another edition comes out with the last chapter perhaps being now on Biden, how would you appraise him?
I would give him an F rating. My book, Prejudential, Black America and the Presidents, is specifically about presidential relations with black people. But Biden, for years he was the right on the right wing of the Democratic Party. He took the lead in fighting against school busing to effectuate desegregation. He said things like the nation could be a racial jungle. He was one of the people who took the lead in passing Bill Clinton's crime bill, which ended up putting so many black people in jail. He's the one who prioritized the genocide in Gaza. They knew it was a political problem for Kamala Harris, but he never relented. A few days before election day, he said, well, this isn't a genocide, it's just Israel defending itself. I would in every way rank him very, very badly. He and his people, they said he was, as I said before, the most progressive since FDR, and nothing like that was true. That was a slogan that they came up with to shut up the left. So I would have nothing good to say about Biden, and ultimately he was the loser. He should have stepped down a year or so before he did, I would say a couple of years. After the midterms in 2022, he was not up to running again. His health wouldn't permit it. And by not stepping down, he set the stage, and not having a primary, he set the stage for Trump's return.
What is your overall appreciation of the geriatric state of American politics, particularly on the top? Trump is 78. Biden would have been in his mid-80s had he got elected. Why don't they have any people coming up from the ranks? Why are they stuck with these people, the octogenarians?
Well, I think it tells you that politics in the U.S. is calcified. We have people who are in office because of their backing of the kind of people we were talking about before. So there is no organic way for new people to get into the system. They are there to make sure that it could be Silicon Valley, it could be weapons manufacturers, it could be Elon Musk or any of the other people we mentioned. Their job is to do their work and to give them advantages. And because that's the way the political system really works, that's why I believe that's the biggest reason it's hard for new people to get in.
Well, Margaret, you know, the age-old question, of course, when left forces, the progressive movement, is faced with what it perceives as a crisis, when the right wing is particularly dominant and is stronger perhaps even than usual. The question, you know, is, well, what is to be done? Where do we go from here? That's the question that is often asked in politics. So what is your thought is in light of the Trump presidency? Does it give us certain opportunities, perhaps, as well as challenges? Talk to us about where you think we should go from here in light of it.
Well, the Democratic Party has to die. Progressives have to give up on the Democratic Party. It's nothing but a money laundering operation for the rich people we've been talking about. They do not even know. I mean, look how badly they messed this up. They thought they could plop Kamala Harris in at the last minute, and she ended up getting 15 million fewer votes than Biden got in 2020. Trump is back in, despite being allegedly disgraced. You've got to dump the Democrats. There has to be a conscious effort to build a left-wing party or parties to work in coalition. The Democratic Party is dead, a spent political force, and the most important thing is for people to stop thinking that it represents their interests at all. The delusion and denial have to end, and so does the Democratic Party. It's a waste of time to try to keep it alive.
The other thing that many are pulling their hair out about on the left is the fact that this is not the first time this has been true, but it's been rather dramatically true in this election, that whereas Latino voters and Black voters had traditionally been much closer to the Democratic Party, certainly than the Republican Party, that's been changing. And it changed somewhat dramatically. I haven't seen all of the figures yet, but it clearly changed somewhat dramatically in this particular election. And the Democratic Party had prided itself, of course, of being the party of people of color and the downtrodden and all of that sort of thing. The Republican Party certainly has not had a record either of doing anything for these folks. So why do you think it was that in this particular election, Latino immigrants and Latinos who have been here for generations, for that matter, people of color, Black people, voted in larger percentages for the Republican Party, for Trump?
It didn't change much for Black people. We saw these polls showing Black men might give 20% of their votes for Trump. It was nothing like that. It was pretty much what it always is, with 12 or 13%, a small increase. Most Latino voters still vote for Democrats. It was in smaller numbers. It was I think 55% or something along those lines. So it has been dropping in recent years. But I will say that the Democrats don't stand for anything. It used to be the party that was going to defend the welfare state, and it isn't anymore. So they couldn't pass increasing the minimum wage. People were kicked off of these programs, SNAP and Medicaid, that were keeping people going during the COVID pandemic, and then they just disappeared. So people lose their political allegiance. Now, Trump is not going to change the economy. People are not going to be doing better. They're not going to reindustrialize the United States and bring jobs back from other countries. That ship sailed. None of those things that they claim are going to happen. But when you don't stand for anything, people can consider something else that may not also work. So if the Democrats really did at least some of the things that they claim to be for, I think they could regain some of that support that they lost.
You call for it, Margaret, if I've understood you correctly, the kind of the end of the Democratic Party as such. Where does your hope lie in terms of then forming a new party, a party that would challenge the capitalist party of the Republican Party, if the capitalist Democratic Party were indeed, as you say, to not be around, although I suspect that's rather unlikely. I guess what I'm really asking is, what do you think is your hope and the best possibilities in this period ahead for creating organizational force that is equal to the task of finally making this country the kind of country that I believe you want it to be for the people and serve the people as it does not now do?
Well, I think if people need to lose their fear I think many more people would vote for smaller parties if they weren't browbeaten into thinking they were spoilers, they wasting their vote. If people would just build whatever it is they want. And I want to add that when smaller parties try to build, they are sabotaged, especially by the Democrats. Here in New York State, for example, Cuomo just took Greens off the ballot, and Greens and other small parties with changes in the nomination process. So people should organize the way they want and outside of the electoral system as well. Vote for who you want. Build for what you want. You know, people who said, I'd like to vote Green or for, you know, right in the PSL or Cornell West, but who voted for Democrats anyway, they still lost. The Democrats are out. They're out of power. That's where we should go next. Organizing electorally within and without the electoral system to get rid of these ruling class run bourgeois parties.
In that same spirit, other times in American history, I'm thinking even more currently, for example, when Trump was elected the first time, it did give rise to a real breath of life into movements, into the Black Rights Movement, Black Lives Matter movement, for example, the women's movement, certainly in the face of Trump's election in 2016. More and more of the young people in this country are favor a different economic system, maybe a socialistic economic system, and so forth and so on. Do you have some hope that perhaps the election of Trump and the ultra-right right position that he intends to push, and he has the entire Congress now, and the Republican Party for that matter, do you think that might again give rise, hopefully, to a more vibrant and stronger independent movement in the streets as well as in the ballot box?
Only if we organize. It can't just be people. Remember the pink pussy cat hats from 2016? It can't be some, you know, manufactured nonsense like that. But if people are ready to organize, yes, it can. We can do, as you mentioned in the past, you know, people in this country. Nixon founded the EPA, the Republican, the Environmental Protection Agency, because there were huge protests. People organized to defeat Republicans. It's that kind of thing we've done during the days of the Black Liberation Movement, all kinds of changes outside of the electoral system. And I think that's where our energies have to go.
So, Margaret, Kimberly, we are sadly out of time, but tell people, our listeners, how can they learn more about Black Agenda Report? How can they follow it and get it and follow your work as well?
Yes, blackagendareport.com is published every Wednesday. We have articles on Wednesday. We have Black Agenda Radio on Friday. We're on, of course, Facebook and Twitter, and I'm on Twitter a lot. Freedom Ride Blog is my handle. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Margaret Kimberly, for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.